Welcome to Straight Thinking, a GPS for the Christian mind, teaching you how to think, not just what to think. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples. Dave Rogsad is not with us today. On today's podcast, has Christianity been marked by truth and goodness? Ken, this is the first of two podcasts on this question. Skeptics seem to be asking a different question than they did not long ago. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's right, Joe. And what I'd like to do in our two podcasts is to make that point that we seem to be at a place where the kinds of questions we receive about Christianity has kind of changed. And I think part of that has to do with kind of the new zeitgeist of the time. So in our first podcast, we'll talk a little bit about reason and truth, and then transition to questions of goodness, whether Christianity has been a good force in the world.
All right, sounds good. I'm raring to go, and I'm sure our listeners are as well.
Well, let me begin by saying that, 30 some years ago, 1987 is when I began working at the Christian Research Institute. I worked there with Walter Martin, and he, of course, is the original Bible Answer Man. And after Walter's death, there was a number of people who'd be on a panel, and we would do the Bible Answer Man program. Later, it was Hank Anagraff who took the show, and he's done it for, since Walter's death. So I remember both doing that program, Joe, and also going to the colleges and universities, because I would go out to a college and give a talk, sometimes to faculty members, other times to students. And in those days, the apologetic presentations I would give were almost exclusively about the truth of Christianity. And so the kinds of questions I would get would be, does God exist? Is Jesus the Son of God? What about the resurrection? But as I have shared, and we've been talking about this in past, but I want to look at it in a little more detail. I noticed, Joe, about 10 or 15 years ago that there was a change in the kinds of questions and the apologetic issues. And the transition, as far as I saw it, was that people nowadays, and now I'm speaking of both college students and faculty members, that they are asking questions about whether Christianity is actually a good religion. And I think, again, that shift is kind of characteristic of the time in which we live. And so what I want to share with people is that when you're asking truth questions, when you ask questions like, does God exist? Or you ask, is Christianity true? Or did Jesus rise from the dead? These are questions about truth. And the standard definition of truth, Joe, has been within Christian history, and I think within Western civilization, it's been what we call a correspondence theory of truth. And what a correspondence theory of truth means is that if you have a belief, and that belief matches or corresponds to reality, then you have the truth. So if I believe that God exists, and God does in fact exist, then I know the truth. If I believe that Christianity is the one exclusively true religion, and that corresponds or matches, then I have the truth. Or, any kind of mundane belief, like I might believe that it's raining, and in fact it is raining, then I know the truth. So that correspondence theory of truth has held sway for a very, very long time. But I think that, in many respects, postmodernism has kind of changed those kinds of things. And so over the last decade or so, and probably, it's probably been even longer than that, I think there's a transition. And some people have suggested that we live in kind of a post-truth world, where truth is less that which corresponds to reality, and truth is more your particular subjective belief. And Joe, I know you've heard people say, you know, that's true for you, but it's not true for me. Or, you know, I remember watching Oprah Winfrey on television. She would say, well, you know, that's your truth, and you have to live within your truth. Well, that's a very mixed up idea if you think of the traditional understanding of there being truth and your belief has to correspond to the nature of reality. Hmm. So that's kind of that transition, I think, that we're living in. And of course, that transition then moves to what I think is a more postmodern perspective. And if you can't know the truth, then you might begin to settle for other types of questions which have to do with goodness.
So let me see if I'm tracking with you so far. Yeah. Because of the postmodern mindset, somebody is not necessarily looking for truth in an absolute sense, but what the truth might be determined according to their group, whatever group they're a part of, and if it corresponds to their particular group or that reality, then it's true. But now we go on to whether it's going to be good for people. So not necessarily true in an absolute sense, but maybe a different kind of way. It's hard for me to get my arms around, because it seems like if it's going to be true, it's got to be true across the board, right?
And that's the challenging question, I think, for anybody who would adopt a kind of postmodern view. Joe, I think what I'd like to do is kind of talk a little bit about these different views about the nature of truth and reality. Just to enumerate them: pre-modernism, modernism, and then post-modernism. Pre-modernism is kind of that traditional view that we've talked about, a correspondence view of truth. Pre-modernism would say that the foundation for truth, but also for meaning or value, all of that is found in God. So, these questions of truth, goodness, and beauty that we talk about, the transcendentals, those would all, in a pre-modern context, be grounded in God. Now, with the Enlightenment period, so we're talking 1700s, you have kind of a shift in perspective. You can call it a zeitgeist. You could even potentially say maybe there's a shift in worldview thinking. That would reflect modernism, and modernism would say that the foundation, the objective foundation for truth, meaning, and value, call it truth, goodness, and beauty if you want, they're no longer founded in God. God is no longer the ground of truth, meaning, and value. For the modern period, that grounding would then come in human beings, in nature, in science. And I mean, that is a real change, where objective reality is determined by God or grounded by God. Then there is this transition to, well, maybe the ground of truth, meaning, and reality move to human beings, to nature and science. But then there's an even greater shift from modernism to postmodernism, where the objective foundation for truth, meaning, and value doesn't exist at all. There is no objective foundation. So when we think of modernism and its contrast to pre-modernism, in some ways it is a stark change, but at least with pre-modernism and modernism, there's still a sense that you've got to ground truth, meaning, and value somewhere. If it's either going to be grounded in God or it's going to be grounded in the natural world or science. But think of pre-modernism, where the objective foundation for truth, meaning, and value, they don't exist. So all you have are subjectivity. There's no way to talk about any kind of objective basis. And that kind of puts us in a position where, how do you determine something is true, good, and beautiful when the categories have shifted?
Yeah. Now, I don't think anybody would want to challenge, say, gravity. They're not going to walk off a building and reject gravity all of a sudden. So is there a mindset on the part of the postmodern person? Is there a mindset that there are some truths that are true for everybody? That's just the way it is. That's the world we live in. Yet for things that center on beliefs and religious preferences and goodness and those kinds of things, is it more subjective in that sense? Are they separating it in any way, Ken? I don't know if you get what I'm trying to...
Well, I think it's certainly the case. I'm certain about this. What I'm certain about, Joe, is that the social sciences, the humanities, have been hit very hard by postmodern thinking. So we see it in philosophy. We see it in psychology. We see it in the study of culture. It probably has not had the same impact on, you know, the STEM areas. I mean, you know, you have in philosophy, you have postmodernism, and part of postmodernism is this kind of deconstruction of language, that maybe words don't carry reliable meaning. Words are equivocal. Well, you know, I always kind of teasingly say, if Jacques Derrida, who is one of the great philosophers behind kind of this postmodern deconstruction, you know, I've joked, does, when he picks up his prescription at Walgreens, you know, does he follow the language that's on the little bottle? Is that language equivocal? Well, Joe, I think in a practical sense, when it comes to our health, we take what our doctors say to us very seriously. And of course, when you look at a prescription, you want to follow it very carefully. You may not take the proper dose. You could even overdose. But nevertheless, there are people who are now saying that postmodernism and its relativity with truth, its relativity with morality, its relativity with language, that it is now entering even into the STEM fields. And again, you have people, I would point out, for example, that there was at one of the Smithsonian museums, of the Museum of African American Art and History, there was an exhibit where it said that, you know, the sciences are simply kind of a reflection of a white Caucasian culture, and that, you know, cause and effect, true and falsity, are kind of just a particular narrative. Well, that's an extreme claim, because you're essentially saying that the scientific model is no longer a model that matches reality. It's simply an artificial perspective that is taken on by the dominant group. I noticed that exhibit was taken down, and I think probably because of that kind of controversy. But here is a point that I think we want to think carefully about. Since postmodernism is highly suspicious of truth claims, and truth claims are part of what we call a meta-narrative, take that word out, that big word if you want, put worldview in if you will, but since postmodernism is highly suspicious of truth claims or meta-narratives, it then tends to evaluate belief systems on the basis of their practical value. So if I could take you to a question here of postmodern truth, I think postmodern truth is characterized by some of the statements that I'm going to give you now, Joe. I would say, for example, some would say postmodern truth is characterized that truth is relative. It's not fixed or absolute. Now, again, think of how far that has moved away from the correspondence theory of truth. You know, if I have a scientific belief, or if I have a philosophical belief and the scientific belief and the philosophical belief match reality, I have the truth. Some would suggest in postmodern truth, truth is relative. It's not fixed. It's not absolute. Well, I think we're on a, I think we're beginning to fall into a quicksand. Now, here's a, here's another characteristic some would suggest of postmodern truth. One can never know something without question. Well, that's a pretty big claim in and of itself. I think even in pre-modernism and in modernism, there would be the question of whether you can have certainty, but you can still have deductive reasoning. I mean, if I say all men are mortal and Joe Aguirre is a man, then I think I can draw the conclusion with certainty that Joe Aguirre is mortal. If all men are mortal, and Joe Aguirre is one of those men who is mortal, then it follows with certainty that he's moral. But in a postmodern context, one can never know something without question. Well, that's not just characteristic of postmodernism. I think, for example, I think postmodernists are probably right to criticize modernism by saying that maybe they've exaggerated their knowledge of the natural world. But let me give you another possible characteristic of postmodern truth. Truth is constructed, not discovered. Let me say that again. Truth is constructed, not discovered. I mean, most of us who have lived in Western civilization have thought that truth is out there and that we have to discover it. We have to use our senses, we have to use our mind, but there is truth to be discovered. Now, again, pre-modernism would say that truth is found in God, and it's found in God's revelation. He's created the natural world. He created us in his image. He's given us special revelation in Christ. Well, for most of us in the pre-modern and modern world, truth is discovered. But again, I think it is probably characteristic of postmodernism to say that truth is constructed, not discovered. Well, if you can't know the truth, Joe, then it could be that people are just giving you subjective constructs of truth. And again, I think what's concerning about all of this, and I think it should concern every person, it seems like the foundation or the ground for truth has been removed. So when, you know, people present a particular philosophy of life or people give us kind of a scientific theory, this is a construct. It's not discoverable. I would characterize postmodernism as a radical subjectivism. There is a subjectivity and a relativity when it comes to truth, when it comes to goodness, when it comes to our knowing about reality itself. Now, go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, would the postmodern person agree that things like 1 + 1 = 2, or the sky is blue, or water is wet, things like that, would they say those are discovered, or are those constructs? Have those been constructed?
Well, I think you're asking the really good questions. It seems like there are some things that are indisputable, right? It seems like mathematical truths, or it seems like our direct observation. I mean, how could you apply such subjectivity to those types of things? I think that most postmodernists are kind of looking at the big picture, these kind of big narratives about the nature of reality. Not necessarily, I mean, it's very difficult to remove basic arithmetic if you adopt certain ideas. But again, I think your point is both a criticism of postmodernism, but where postmodernism kind of strikes is kind of these big narratives. Hmm. Now, we could also maybe add to this mix, Joe, is that people construct truths that work for them. I mean, look, here's a way of thinking about this. If nobody can really know the truth, of course, that's contradictory. You'd have to then say, well, the truth is there's no truth. So, I mean, all of this starts to come apart. Not only your direct observation of the sky being blue or 1 + 1 = 2. But I mean, if you say there's no truth, then there's at least one truth, and that is there is no truth, which is itself a truth. So I'm not in any way saying that any of this stuff holds together logically, but I think that these beliefs are slowly and gradually, and maybe not so slowly anymore, they're kind of taking over. So in a postmodern context, if people can't know the truth, then they relegate themselves to what is practical, and therefore they construct truths that work for them. Now again, I'm not saying any of this makes a lot of sense, but if you adopt the basic view that nobody can ultimately know the truth, and therefore you shift gears into kind of a pragmatism, then you might construct a story that works for you. Mm-hmm. And I think we encounter this a lot in our culture today. I think when people are talking about woke culture, mm-hmm. I think when people are talking about our views of social justice and our views of race relationships, some people would suggest that the dominant culture, which of course would be perceived as being the Caucasian white culture, has kind of constructed these kinds of truths. Now, again, you can, I mean, think about some of these other ideas that are packaged here. What is true for one may not be true for another. One truth is as valid as any other. And truth can be revised without contradiction. Well, I don't believe that, but again, I mean, Joe, what if you adopted the view that you can't really know the truth, so people are kind of relegated to using a story about truth as a power play, so everybody has a spin, everybody has an agenda. And Joe, these kinds of things that I've just described, I think we see all of these. Now, again, let me give them to you. I'm reading here for the people listening at home or in your car or wherever you listen to Straight Thinking. We're sure glad that you do. Here are those characteristics that to one degree or another characterize postmodern truth. Truth is relative, not fixed or absolute. One can never know something without question. Truth is constructed rather than discovered. People construct truths that work for them. What is true for one may not be true for another. One truth is as valid as another. Truth can be revised without contradiction. And then spin, agenda, is everything. Now, Joe, think about these ideas in the media culture, let's say you have Google and Yahoo, and I like anybody else will do a Google search. In the old days I would do a Yahoo search, but let's say I wanted to do a search on some political philosophy, or I wanted to do a search on some controversial idea. Well, then the question is, who is arranging the data that pops up during your search? Well, it's not too far to, it's not difficult to understand that in a postmodern world, wow, I mean, things are equivocal, things are moving around, things seem to lack a foundation. And, you know, I've always thought that postmodernism was largely a university thing. And what I mean by that is I thought postmodernism was largely kind of an intellectual, projected philosophical system that, you know, top-notch philosophers held. But Joe, I think all of this has become part of our culture now. And so again, as we think about this kind of postmodernism, I think that it is primarily defined as a extremely relativistic, and it's, there's relativism in truth, there's relativism in morality. It's a slippery place.
Yeah. I wonder what the postmodern person would think as far as getting along with everybody in a community if everybody's truth is just as valid as somebody else's. That is, what's behind all this is, I'm wondering if they perceive that if you claim to have the truth, that's arrogant. So we all look better if we're less arrogant. So whatever truth you can latch onto, if that works for you, that's great. But doesn't that come, aren't these going to rub against each other at some point if you're trying to get along with your neighbor and live in a community? It just makes me wonder about all that and how people are getting along just by holding to their own truth.
Yeah, I think so. I as much as I have kind of set up this three-tiered, you know, pre-modernism, modernism, postmodernism. Joe, I'd also want to say I think a lot of these ideas are not new. I mean, when I was a college student and I was studying Plato and Aristotle and Socrates, kind of the big three Greek thinkers, there was a whole group of rhetoricians. I guess you might call them philosophers. They were called the Sophists. And they believed in a relativism of truth. They believed that, ideas were more power plays than they were truth issues. So to some degree, this kind of relativism, when it comes to truth, goodness, and beauty, it's not new. There has always been this kind of deep skepticism. There have always been people who have suggested that you shouldn't focus so much on what is actually true, but how useful it is, how practical it is. Mm-hmm. I think that's part of American culture. I mean, when I was thinking about getting a philosophy degree, some people would suggest, and my father would have been one of them, that, well, why would you want to get a degree in a subject that doesn't have any real practical relevance? Why, you know, how much money does it pay? Why would you go and get a degree in a particular area that's not going to pay off, so to speak? Now, again, that's that kind of American pragmatism. If I could pitch it in a very different sense. I mean, I could ask the question, what if I were a person who had a good mastery of ideas and beliefs and truths and was able then to shape the way people thought? I mean, that also has a certain pragmatism, but I think to some degree, we're raising questions. Maybe the study of truth or the study of ideas or the study of beliefs may not be as practical as becoming a plumber or, you know, becoming an engineer. But you could ask, well, what is the practical result? I mean, it seems to me, Joe, the postmodern philosophers have really influenced our world. They really have shaped our world.
Ken, another question, and I don't want to take us too far afield, but sure. Somebody might say, look, we live in a global society now where many different cultures can be found in your own community. I know that's true of my community here. I'm sure yours as well. Anybody who lives in a city of any size in this country or anywhere in the West is going to find the world really represented at their doorstep. So this is a way for us just to get along and respect other cultures. So if they have their own truth, what's the big deal? Let them be. How would you look at that?
Yeah, and I think that that kind of value system, I think what is the kinds of values that are reflected by that comment, that I think it already has adopted a very skeptical view of the world. It seems to me a person who would say that, hey, you know, I think a person who would reflect that sentiment, Joe, is essentially saying, you really can't know the truth. So let's not put truth, goodness, and beauty on the highest level. Let's put practical agreement. You know, can't we all get along? But of course, maybe the casualty of the viewpoint, can't we all get along? And by the way, I think that there is important elements in that. I mean, I think Christianity is the one true religion. And I think the other religions have some truth, but they also have deep error in them. So I believe that the only way to God is through Jesus Christ. And yet, I also admit, Joe, that I think it's important that Muslims and Christians can get along because they make up 55% of the world's population. And yet I would say, I don't think getting along should take us away from the pursuit of the truth. And so I think in that sentiment that you have expressed, Joe, that's already adopted a view that the practical ramifications of life are more important than the ultimate issues of truth, goodness, and beauty. So, you know, that kind of pragmatism has already essentially said, well, nobody can really know the truth. So why not just accept all religions? And Joe, again, we're kind of back to the ancient world. As much as postmodernism is new, it's not new. In the ancient Roman world, you know, as long as you didn't challenge Caesar's authority, you could believe anything you wanted to. But what about when people say Jesus is Lord? What about when you say that Jesus is God and my ultimate submission has to be to him, not to the Roman Caesar? I think the Romans were logical enough to see that Christians were making an authority claim and that challenged them. Joe, what I'd like to do now is maybe center what I think the issue is for us. I think it's possible, and I'd like to hear your feedback on this. I have begun to believe that there really is kind of two types of atheists, and I'm concentrating on the atheist in particular, but it could be somebody who is just kind of broadly skeptical and who has not yet given up belief in God. But here is an idea that I heard set forth. I was at an ISCA conference, the International Society of Christian Apologetics, ISCA, and there was a Baptist philosopher, and I'm sorry, I can't remember his name. I probably could go back and discover it, but I thought he gave a very interesting talk. He said there are two types of atheists. There's one atheist who says, I think there is a rational basis for Christianity. At least there is a purported rational basis for Christianity. But the reality is that I don't want that God to exist. I don't find that acceptable. The idea that there would be one God, that I would have to submit myself to it. So that first type of atheist is essentially saying that the challenge for me is not the rationality. There may be a rational claim to be made for Christianity, but I don't prefer that God. I don't prefer that religion. And again, I'm kind of mixing a little perspective here by saying, I remember listening to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, the great NBA center, Hall of Famer, longtime Los Angeles Laker. Kareem came from a Catholic family, grew up in New York, later came to Southern California and played at UCLA in college. Well, I remember one day listening to Kareem, and Kareem said that one of the reasons he had left Catholicism or Christianity and had adopted Islam was that Islam was preferable to him because he thought they had done a better job of dealing with race issues, that minorities were treated better in Islam than they were in Christianity. And I thought to myself, I thought a lot of things. One, I thought I'd love to have a dialogue, a discussion with Kareem. He's a very thoughtful man. But I thought, Kareem, are you settling this not on truth, but on preference? That is, that first atheist, again, is saying, there may be a rationality for Christianity, but I don't want that God to exist. I mean, was Kareem saying essentially, I prefer the Islamic God to the Christian God because I'm a Black man and I think Islam offers more to racial minorities than Christianity does? I'm just trying to give you an example of somebody who might say, well, there may be a rational basis for Christianity, but I don't want God to exist. I don't know if Thomas Nagel fits this exactly, but you know, Thomas Nagel, Joe, has some very high-powered Christian friends. I mean, Thomas Nagel is a professor of philosophy of mind at New York University. I don't know, he may be emeritus by now, but the story is that Thomas Nagel said, look, it bothers me that some of my smart friends actually believe in God. And I think he was clearly noting people like Alvin Plantinga and other leading philosophers. But Nagel said categorically, Joe, I don't want Christianity to be true. Now, does he think there is a rational basis? I think he does. I think Thomas Nagel actually thinks there is a potential rationale, logic, reason, science that could support a Christian theistic perspective. But Nagel says at the end of the day, I don't want that God to exist. So that's our first atheist. Our first atheist is saying, look, there may be a rational basis to believe in God, but I don't prefer that God. I don't want that God. Now, let's place the second atheist position. The second atheist may say, you know, I think it might be interesting if God did exist. I think it might be good if there was a God. If there was a God, maybe there'd be life after death. Maybe I could be reconciled to my loved ones. Maybe that God would mean that this world is not the end. And maybe you could anchor morality in that God. Or to put it another way, maybe you have, Joe, an atheist who reads the Chronicles of Narnia or the Lord of the Rings and kind of puts the story together and says, wow, maybe if there was a God, there would be truth, goodness, and beauty. Maybe there would really be an anchor for that. But the second atheist takes a different position. The second atheist says, well, I might be willing to consider that there's a God, and it might be a good thing if there was a God, but there's no rational basis. Now, I don't know that this atheist fits the category. I'm a little hesitant to, you know, to posit a particular atheist individual and place him in the category because I'm kind of using this as a paradigm. Mm-hmm. I'm really making a model, right? And I want to be careful that I don't push somebody into a category where they don't fit. I don't know for certain that Thomas Nagel would say, yeah, Ken's got it right with me. But I think some things Nagel has said make me think, well, he doesn't think Alvin Plantica and Richard Swinburne are crazy. He thinks they're first-rate philosophers, so he must think that there's some rational basis. But Nagel has been very clear. Nagel has essentially said, look, I just don't want that God to exist. That's not the God I want to believe in. Now, let me tell you about another atheist. And again, I don't know that he fits this, but he said things that make me think. And it's a man named Graham Oppie, last name O-P-P-Y, Graham Oppie. I think Oppie did his doctoral studies in philosophy, I want to say at Princeton. But he is a leading atheist philosopher. He's from Australia, teaches at one of the universities down under. And I've watched Oppie debate people like William Lane Craig, Josh Rasmussen, who is a Christian philosopher at Azusa Pacific University. And what I thought was very interesting one day is, Joe, that Oppie said, Oppie was kind of given a question like, would you be attracted if there was a God? Or the question was kind of presented, would it be good if there was a God? Or, is there some attraction to the idea of God existed? Now, I don't remember exactly how that question was worded, but I remember very clearly Oppie's response. He said, but belief in God is impossible. So why should I consider a God like that's reflected in the Narnia or in Middle Earth in literature? Or why should I consider a God that's presented in Christianity or Islam when belief in God's impossible? Now, that's a very strong position. You know, there have been a lot of atheists who would say, I think God's existence is highly improbable. You know, that maybe the reasonableness is very, very low. You know, maybe there's only 10% chance that there's a God. But Oppie came right out and said, I just think God can't exist. It's impossible. So he thought that there must be a defeater for the rationality. Now, again, if I can bring you back to those two atheists, the one atheist says, you know, there may be some rational basis. I mean, these Christians are not crazy. I mean, I would encourage you to read a little bit of Augustine and Anselm and Aquinas. And I would challenge you to say those guys are crazy. I mean, I don't think they're crazy. I think these are some of the brightest bulbs. And there are some pretty bright bulbs alive today. Alvin Plantico, Richard Swinburne. Look in the sciences, Hugh Ross, John Lennox. Whatever field you want to introduce, I can introduce you to some pretty bright Christians who are influential in the field. Let's look at literature. I mean, Chronicles of Narnia have sold 100 million, The Lord of the Rings, 150 million. Both Lewis and Tolkien were dedicated Christians. Lewis an Anglican, Tolkien a Catholic. I can always introduce you to people in whatever field you want who are pretty reasonable people. But the first atheist says, look, I'm willing to grant that there may be some rationale. There may be a reasonable basis for believing Christianity, but I just don't prefer it. The second atheist comes along and says, well, I could see some benefit to believing in God. It might be good if there was a God, if God could guarantee life after death and things like that, but it's just not rationally possible. Do those two types, how do they strike you, Joe?
I'm hearing and concurring. I'm just wondering if the new atheist would fit either of those categories, because they seem to have a bit of an edge to them when they discuss whether Christianity is rational.
No, I'm really glad you brought that up, because I think if you were to look at Christopher Hitchens or Sam Harris or Dan Dennett or Richard Dawkins, the four horsemen, right, of the new atheism, I think the tendency is to think that they think there's no rationality and there's no good reason to prefer Christianity. They would attack it in both ways.
Mm.
They think it's not reasonable, and the reason that it's not good is because it's not reasonable. It doesn't work. I agree. I'm not suggesting that every atheist would necessarily fit in those two categories, but it does set up the idea that in the past we've spent a lot of time, we meaning Christian apologists have spent a lot of time in arguing that there is a rational foundation for Christianity, that belief in God is reasonable. In fact, it may be the most reasonable position. Or we've argued that atheist claims are not defeaters, like the problem of evil does not eliminate God. It's not logically necessary to conclude that God doesn't exist. And so apologists have spent a lot of their time and a lot of their abilities on trying to show that God is reasonable. But we haven't spent nearly as much time trying to persuade people that it would be a good idea if there was a God.
Hmm.
And what I'm suggesting is, now again, you're right. You were exactly right to bring up the new atheists. I think with Hitchens and Dawkins, I think they would suggest that there's no rational basis to believe in God, and there's no good reason to hope that there's a God based upon, you know, the disaster. Religion poisons everything, as Hitchens would say. But of course, I don't know what's in their heart exactly. I mean, you know, I remember one day I was teaching a class at Cerritos College. This is a community college, a two-year college in the suburb of Los Angeles, very close to where I grew up as a boy. And one of my philosophy colleagues, we were sharing an office together, and a student came in who was in the class of one of my colleagues. My teaching friend, who also name was Joe, he said, Ken, this is so-and-so, and he's a class skeptic. He's a doubter. So I said to him, I said, do you ever doubt that you doubt? I said, are you such a doubter that you doubt that you doubt? And of course he smiled, the student smiled and said, of course not. But I then said, are you as skeptical about your skepticism as you are about other people's religious beliefs?
Mm-hmm.
Now, when it comes to the four atheists, the four horsemen, Joe, do they have doubts? I mean, I do. I wrote a book without a doubt, but I have doubts, so I must be a big hypocrite. There are times where I think, wow, could I be wrong about my beliefs? Or I think, you know, when I think of the pandemic and I see people having, for example, there was a recent incident where a Christian philosopher and his wife were killed in an automobile accident and left four children. And people were racing and they crashed into this Christian couple who had just gone out on a date night. And I thought, wow, what could be God's purpose in allowing that? Now, so my only point here is to say there are sometimes, now I'm going to quote C.S. Lewis, there are sometimes as a Christian that you look at the world and you think, maybe believing in God isn't as practical as I thought. Maybe maybe I have doubts about my faith every once in a while. And I do. Now again, I'm going to say, I think anybody who is a thinker is going to have doubts. And I don't think doubt is always a bad thing. And I would also say, I think there are different kinds of doubt. There's doubt about arguments and facts and evidence. But I think there's other doubts about, you can kind of have an emotional doubt. And I think my doubts are more like that. I think there are times when I'm in kind of a depressed mood, that mood may become a doubter's mood. All of that simply to say, Joe, does Dawkins and Hitchens and Harris and Dennett, do they have moods where belief in God might actually seem likely or probable?
Yeah, it does make you wonder, especially in light of Romans chapter 1 and other places. By the way, we welcome Dave Rogstad now.
Sorry about that.
Hey, Dave.
You had an appointment, huh?
Actually,
we're still recording remotely, by the way, in case people are wondering. But good to have you join us now, Dave.
Thank you. I wasn't doing bad things. I was out praying in my backyard, and I just got totally forgot about joining you. So sorry.
So communing with the triune God outweighs your work at Straight Thinking, huh?
I guess so.
Well,
I'd like to make a comment about what you just were discussing.
Yeah, please.
You know, I have, as you know, friends who are atheists. And at least one of them has great fear of death, great fear of that he's wrong. But it doesn't seem to bring him over to the light. It seems like those fears are there, but they somehow suppress those fears.
Yeah.
And they pop up and they show up in different circumstances, but somehow they're effective in suppressing them.
You know, Dave, what I think is interesting here is we're talking about whether Christian theists have doubts and whether atheistic naturalists have doubts, whether they go through moods. I would say, for example, I remember when I was very, very sick and thinking was very difficult for me. I had abscess brain lesions and lots of medications in my system, and I wasn't thinking as lucidly as I like to think. Well, I went through a period where I thought, wow, maybe how do I know my worldview is correct? And, you know, I kind of had to hold on because I wasn't kind of in my right mind, so to speak. Now, you know, when people are depressed or people go through tough times, I mean, my heart goes out to people during this pandemic who have not been able to earn a living. You know, I remember my father, late in his working career, got laid off. I never saw my dad, so depressed. And of course work was such an important part of his life. And he thought, wow, you know, he had insecurities. Well, my point here is simply to say, maybe when people go through moods of doubt, maybe it is influenced by their mindset or their circumstances. But then, of course, then I wonder, are there times where atheists kind of let their mindset entertain the idea that maybe there is a God? Maybe I could be wrong about my beliefs. Dave, what do you think about that? Did you hear our discussion of the two types of atheists?
No, I missed out. Sorry about that.
Well, let me just simply state, and then I'll pause and let you comment. I'm suggesting there may be some good reason to think there are two types of atheists. Now, I'm not saying these are the only types, but one type would be a person who says, you know, there may be some rationality to Christianity. There may be arguments that carry a certain rational probability or truth about God existing, but I don't want that God to exist.
Right.
Then the other atheist, the type, and I'm using a paradigm or a model, the second type of atheist would say, you know, there could be a God, and maybe it would be good if there were, because I would survive the death of my body, maybe, but I just can't believe it because there's no good reason. So those are my two types. What do you think of those two types? And do you think, because you have friends who are atheists, that atheists go through moods where maybe belief in God seems possible or probable?
Well, I agree that there's certainly those two different types of people. In fact, if I think about some of the ones that I have engaged with, maybe one is in one category and the other is in the other category. And so arguing with them or discussing with them takes quite a different style or approach in doing it. Underlying both of them, though, it seems like there's an anger or a bitterness. There's something that has caused them to be hurt by Christians or by circumstances in life, or something that has steered them in this direction, and they almost become inoculated. It seems like there's this thing that is in them, this barrier is so high, or they've built it up so high that it doesn't, they don't have the freedom to engage you in the possibility that maybe they're wrong. They just, I don't know how to describe it, but it just seems like they can immediately dismiss any argument or any discussion that you have to question them on what they, the direction they've gone or the position they've taken. And it's frustrating because you see that I've used the word inoculation. I think others have used that. Mm-hmm. They just have this, so that, you know, they may be willing to acknowledge that what you have to say is right, but they somehow have the ability to just immediately dismiss it because of this barrier that they've erected in their life. I don't know if that makes any sense, but.
You know, it's interesting when we open scripture and we begin to, you know, explore the Christian worldview, what the Bible says about the human condition. We know that people are made in the image of God. And, you know, John Calvin, the great systematic theologian in the Protestant Reformed tradition, Calvin thought that Romans 1 really kind of conveyed what he called in Latin a sensus divinitatis, that all people had an awareness of God, and that Paul seems to indicate in our conscience. And of course, further, Scripture indicates that there's general revelation, not just in the mind of the person, in the conscience of the person, but it's also in nature. Psalm 19, Romans 1. And yet, Scripture also seems to indicate that a natural predisposition is to suppress the knowledge. Now, I guess the question, Dave, a question I posed to Joe, I'd like to pose to you. Do you think it's possible that as apologists, we have spent most of our time trying to show people why it's rational to believe in God or why it's reasonable to believe in the truth of Christianity, but maybe we haven't taken enough time to persuade them that it would be good if there was a God? you know, I've been reading more of Tolkien and Lewis, and by more, I mean I've been reading their fiction. I'm not naturally a fiction kind of person. I prefer nonfiction, but the ideas in the fiction of Lewis and Tolkien are so engaging, it's just drawn me in. Mm-hmm. And I often think that the fiction of Lewis and Tolkien are trying to show us that believing in courage and believing in wisdom and believing in goodness, or to use the three transcendentals, truth, goodness, and beauty, that to have those, they have to have a foundation in God. And I think to some degree, Lewis and Tolkien are trying to, you know, slowly, maybe Lewis more overtly than Tolkien, but I think they're telling us a story that puts a hunger in our hearts and our minds that we want truth, goodness, and beauty. That will fulfill the Imago Dei. So here's my question, Dave, for you that I asked Joe earlier. Have we spent too much time trying to present the reasonableness of Christianity and maybe not enough time explaining why it's good to believe in God or the goodness of God, mm-hmm. or what God has done for the world?
You know, as you well know, I'm a lover of Tolkien and Lewis and those of that persuasion. So I certainly identify with the feelings that you have when you read these particular authors. And yes, I don't know that I want to say that we've spent too much time on the rational aspects of it, as opposed to these more imaginative aspects. But I think that, I guess, something that has struck me much more lately is that it takes a long time for a person to move from wherever they're at into acknowledging that God has a claim on their life. I just look at my own life and I think that it was years of fooling around on the edges and thinking about different aspects of it and being convicted about this or that, and then not giving it attention and letting it go. And then finally, at some point in my life, in my case, it was when I was a graduate student at Caltech, that I really began to look at it seriously, Christianity, as opposed to just, you know, something that I didn't necessarily give much attention to. And so we certainly have to be patient with people so that we may have some very good arguments and we may be able to, you know, answer all of their logical or reasonable questions. But this emotional aspect, the imaginative aspect, I think that's the thing that has to work on them over an extended period of time. There's not just an immediate answer. It's more of a slow persuasion that goes on. And it's interesting that I have given, there's another atheist that I've never mentioned much that I had in my group at JPL. And I got him to read Mere Christianity at one point. And he was really impressed with the way in which Lewis expressed himself, and really couldn't find anything that was really wrong with it, but he didn't become a Christian. And this has been, you know, probably 15 or 20 years ago now. I still have some relationship with him. He's moved out of the area, so I don't have any direct contact with him. But recently I got him to read Justin Brierley's book. I don't understand. They acknowledge that these things are good, but it doesn't seem to move them.
You know, this is, this I think puts us in a good position to transition to our topic next time. We're again connecting it to our discussion today. You know, is there a rational basis for Christianity? Then is Christianity good? And Joe, what I'd like to do in our next program is very quickly kind of touch on what I think are some of the best reasons to believe in God, but then to spend the rest of the show talking why I think Christianity is good. And, you know, maybe positing the two as atheists, maybe that's not the right fit. Maybe I should posit the two as skeptics or as agnostics, because an agnostic could say, well, you know, I believe in, you know, six of one and half a dozen of the other. But Joe, and to some extent, what I'm doing here comes out in the new book that I have that the Lord willing will be available in April of 2021, where I spend half the book arguing for the reasonableness of Christianity and the second half arguing that Christianity has been a really good force. So our listeners have that to look forward to in just a few months.
Great.
That's right. Terrific. Well, thank you for your comments, Ken. I have a comment for you that's come in through social media. It says, Ken, I start my first graduate theology course in February, and I'm getting a head start on the reading, and I can't tell you how much your book, Classic Christian Thinkers, helped prepare and prime me for the reading required for the seminary course. It improves my confidence with the course texts when I see names in the citations and footnotes like Irenaeus, Athanasius, Augustine, and Anselm, and I can go, hey, I know a thing or two about them. That's from Chris Kemp.
Isn't that a great note? Boy,
that's wonderful. That, yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, glad he found that book useful. Many of us have. Be sure to pick it up if you haven't read it yourself, Classic Christian Thinkers. All right, that's going to wrap it up for this podcast. As Ken mentioned, we'll pick it up again on the next one. Be sure to visit Ken's blog site as well, reflectionsbyken.wordpress.com, where you can read the latest that's on Ken's mind. And let us know your comments and questions. Some of you have figured out ways to do that. Here's one deliberate way, @RTB_case samples. This podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Look for the Reasons to Believe podcast, and you'll find Straight Thinking there. For Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory, but truth. Thanks for listening, and join us for the next edition of Straight Thinking.
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.